Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to speak here. I want to talk about the relationship between K-Schur functions and quantum Schubert polynomials via the total lattice. And I want to start with the two parts to the story, one's combinatorial and one's more abstract. I'm going to start with the combinatorial part, and first I'm going to tell you how, if you know what quantum Schubert polynomials are, how to get a K-Schur function, and if you know what K-Schur functions are, how to get quantum Schubert polynomials, and if you don't know what either one is, then, So I'll start with quantum Schubert polynomials, and I won't quite tell you what exactly they are, but I'll tell you what kind of objects they are. So this is a definition of Fermin, Gelfand, Posnikov. So you have a permutation in a symmetric group Sn, and here's my notation for a quantum Schubert polynomial. So for each permutation in Sn, this polynomial is a polynomial in x's, x1 to up to xn. And you're also allowed to use q's, q1, q2, up to qn minus 1. And they represent quantum Schubert classes in the quantum cohomology of the flag variety. I'll write this. They're polynomials in these, but sort of when you say they represent quantum Schubert classes, they represent in a quotient, and I'm going to say that more precisely later on, but I'm going to, instead of telling you the definition of these things, I'm just going to give you a few examples of what they look like. So take n equals 3. So this is a picture of the six permutations in S3. These are the quantum Schubert polynomials. So you have six quantum Schubert polynomials. Okay. One way to define these polynomials is if you know what a Schubert polynomial is. There's a particular basis you can expand your Schubert polynomials into, and then there's a linear map which adds a sort of quantizes it and gives you a quantum Schubert polynomial. But I won't need that, and I won't tell you what that is. And also, you might not know what a Schubert polynomial is. So. Does that help? So next is K-Schur function. Where K is equal to n minus 1. So K-Schur functions, as Luke was saying, is some philosophy or idea started by Lapointe, Lescure, and Morse. But the definition I'm using is Lapointe and Morse's. The definition that I'm using here. And this is the one without a T, which we're in this workshop we've been using this notation for. This is the notation for it. I'm going to tell you that they're symmetric functions lying in the subring. So they're symmetric functions which can be expanded in the first K homogeneous symmetric functions, And the second thing is to tell you what the lambda varies over. Lambda is equal to k lambda varies over k bounded partitions. Okay, and I'll just give you some examples instead of telling you the definition. So for the same case, k equals 2 corresponds to n equals 3. Is this too low? Okay. Then here's a formula for the K-share function. So K-share functions k equals 2, you need two, they're labeled by two bounded partitions, and in this particular case, there's a rather simple formula for them. E is the homogeneous symmetric function. So in this special case of k equals 2, a k-share function is the product of some number of homogeneous, some number of elementary, and then maybe another an extra homogeneous symmetric function. So first, I want to tell you some results about K-share functions, just one result, which we already came up in Luke's talks in the summer school, but I'll review it. So a K-rectangle is a special kind of partition. So K-rectangles are sort of partitions of the following form: Ri is equal to k minus I plus 1 to the I. So that looks something like a shape looking like this. That's a k rectangle. So if k equals 2, there's two of these things. K equals 3, it looks like this. One advantage of using k rectangles is that I don't have to tell you whether I'm using English or French notation. And a theorem of Laporte and Morse is that you can factor out k rectangles out of k share functions, and can write this. Let's just write it like this. Union R is equal to S lambda K S R. Union of two partitions is the union of their parts. And this is true whenever I is a K rectangle. So whenever I is one of these RIs up there. This is your sure function. So in fact, modulo this theorem, every K-share function is determined by finitely many K-share functions. And the ones left over are called K-irreducibles, but I won't need that terminology. Okay, so let me tell you the way to go between these polynomials and these polynomials down here. and this is sort of some translation of work of Costant and Peterson, and from my point of view, based upon sort of comes out of work that I did with Mark Shimazono. So you take the substitution. Qi goes to so this is some kind of rational substitution, and I'll explain exactly what it means in a moment. I'll explain also this notation down here. Yes.
Could you speak a bit about the indexing to make sure that this makes sense? The Qi really, you go from, in the quantum tree, you go from Q1 to Qk minus 1.
Qk, Qn minus 1, Qk.
So here you have n equal 3, and you only have a Q1. Which is
I think. Let me think. Do I not? So there's two possibilities. One is I made a mistake, and there should be a Q2. But I think the likely possibility is you somehow when you take these representatives, you don't need it. So these polynomials, I'll explain a bit later, is that these polynomials are meant to live in a quotient. And in the quotient, you're allowed to swap some Qs for some Q2s. Some Q1s might be allowed to be swapped for some Q2s. And this map is supposed to be defined on the quotient. So there's also a possibility that I just copied that wrong. And I'm trying to think whether I did that. But I think... does anyone know? Does anyone know off the top of their head? Yes. Yeah. I haven't explained this anymore yet. The question was about why there are no Q2s in this picture. Yeah, I mean, there are no X3s because you're meant to work in the quotient where the sum of the X's is zero. Right. So yeah, but I'm wondering whether I actually got the representatives. They chose some particular ones, and I'm wondering whether I just copied it wrong. But okay. But so definitely in the quotient, you can swap between the Qs and swap between the Xs, and you will need the other ones. But sorry. That's the square. Thank you. You know this better than me, apparently. Okay. And so what are the primes? So where? Let me finish the sentence. Where r prime I equals r prime minus the unique removable corner, which may be in a different place depending on whether you're English or French, so I won't draw it. And SR0 is equal to S sub R sub N is equal to 1, but the primes are equal to 0. Okay. So these are the boundary cases. Okay, so if you take this substitution, so there's a comma here, where this then sends this thing to and I'm going to be a little bit imprecise here, but I'll reformulate everything later on and it'll be clear how to make this precise. Some K-share function over some product of K rectangles. So I haven't told you which K-share function appears, but I'll tell you that you can get every modulo K rectangles, you can get every K-share function in this way. So they do complete, they this class, if you know every single one here, then you can determine every single one of these things, and conversely, via the substitution. Any questions? So I'll just do one example of this substitution. So in this k equals 2, n equals 3 case, then there are two k rectangles, vertical and horizontal domino. So you have SR1 is equal to H2. SR2 is equal to E2. And then X1 squared X2 plus Q1 X1 gets sent to S sub 1 is X sub 1, which is E sub 1, so I'll use. Okay, so if I copied down my own substitution correctly, then you get something, a typical kind of thing that you get from this substitution is something which looks like this. And if you put everything over a common denominator and calculate ... you get S1 over E2 H2, which is not very interesting. So you get the so the bottom is a product of some K rectangles, and the top is a K-share function. In this case, the extra H1 stuff is actually what you got here. So that's not very impressive, but Mike was very impressed last year when I showed him this, and I did n equals 4, and he was extremely impressed. Okay, so So that's the combinatorial side, and now I want to talk about the more abstract side, so where this comes from. And so I'll start by talking about the total lattice, and since this is a workshop on affine Schubert calculus, I should explain a bit more about the total lattice since it might not be familiar. So you're meant to take so this is a Hamiltonian system, and you take n particles, that's the same n, with positions, usually you write positions qi and momenta pi, but since there's already a q in quantum Schubert polynomials, I'll put a tilde over here, since they're not exactly the same thing, though they are related. Really? I think it's the other way around. Pi is momenta. I don't know. I mean, you might put xi. Well, yeah. I think this is normal for Hamiltonian system. I mean, maybe the physicists can correct me. And then and then you pick the, so total lattice is the Hamiltonian system with Hamiltonian. So that's some function in the, that's some function in these guys, h of t q is sum I equals 1 to n squared over 2. So this is the kinetic energy of the system. So I equals 1 to n minus 1. And this is the interaction term. Tilde minus q I plus 1 tilde. So this is the kinetic energy, and this is the interaction, and the interaction is only between kind of adjacent particles. So you think of your n particles as lying on a line, and then there's some interaction between adjacent ones. So there's one, this is q, you imagine them that they're ordered on the line, and the interaction between of the entire system is the sum of the interactions between kind of adjacent particles, and the intersection between adjacent particles is this exponential in the difference. Okay, so what does this is the energy of the system, and so the basics of Hamiltonian mechanics is that you think of the PIs as functions of time, and you can get the differential equations in which the system evolves by the following general formulae. So what does it mean? It's a Hamiltonian system. So IEP tilde. So these are all functions of time. And the way these functions evolve over time is by these Hamiltonian equations. And the evolution is completely determined by knowledge of H. Q tilde I dt. Okay, so this is just a general formula. Whenever you have a Hamiltonian, you've got P comma Q, and you can do this. Okay. Okay, so what you want to do when you're confronted with this is to solve this sort of system of differential equations explicitly. And there's a number of ways to solve it. And of course, Tota solved this. But what Costant noticed, I think this is the late 70s, was that this looks like a simple root, this thing here. And so you might think to replace this by this thing up here by a simple root of other types, and then get another system and try to solve it using representation theory. And that's what he did. A standard way to study these systems is to write it in a write the system of differential equations in a lax pair formulation. And so I'm going to define this this matrix. And these x's are the same as the x's in the quantum Schubert polynomials. So here's just some matrix, and the x's are xi's are sort of scalar multiples of the ti tildes, and the qi's are scalar multiples of not the qi tildes but e to the qi tildes. And then you can, I won't tell you what it is, but you can figure it out when I write the next statement. So the statement is that these differential equations can be rewritten in terms of matrix commutation in the following way. So dl dt is equal to l, l minus, where l minus is strictly lower triangular part of L. So that you just take everything upper triangular and set it to zero. And that's if you work out what that this equation says, then it actually gives you this set of equations after this sort of rescaling thing here. And so whenever you reformulate a Hamiltonian system in this way, you have the advantage that you have lots of integrals of motion, and you indeed in this case you get what's called an integral system. So you have many conserved quantities. So some general theory, whenever you've reformulated your system of differential equations in this way, general theory tells you that that there's a bunch of things which are invariant under these differential equations, and that's the traces of this powers of this matrix, or the coefficients of the characteristic polynomial. So trace of L k plus 1 over k plus 1 hk, these are commuting Hamiltonian. So what does that mean? So it means that as this this sort of system of functions evolves according to this differential equation, these things will be conserved. These quantities will be conserved. And actually, you could treat each of these guys as a Hamiltonian. So you can treat each of these things as one of these ectures, and evolve using these equations in those directions, and all these evolutions will commute. So H1 is our original. It turns out that H1 is our original Hamiltonian. And because I'm kind of doing something which is SLN, I'm going to assume that this is a traceless matrix. So H0, which is the trace, is I'm just going to assume is always zero, and that's preserved by the evolution of the system. So because this guy has lots of conserved quantities, it's called an integrable system. So this is total lattice is an integral system. Many commuting, let's say many conserved quantities. Okay. Any questions? Yeah. So there's an analog of this for any. Any simple algebraic group. Okay. So rather than studying the whole total lattice, for the purpose of this talk, we only want to study a particular leaf of the total lattice, which is actually the most degenerate leaf. So Y0 is the set of matrices of the form L, such that L is nilpotent, which actually is the same thing as all of these guys being zero. This is called the nilpotent leaf. coefficient leaf of total lattice. So a caution is that this is not actually a single orbit under these commuting flows, even though it's called the Newtonian leaf, but it's not like a single leaf. It's got some special points where the evolution gets stuck. But it has a dense set, which is a single orbit of the Hamiltonian flows. And that's this. So this is a dense subset of Y0, and your single orbit of so if you start somewhere inside here, so if you pick one matrix inside here, and then you flow according to these differential equations in all the directions. Each of these give a different direction. If you flow in all the directions, you get everywhere inside here. That's the claim. Okay. And the theorem of Givantao and Kim, and I guess improved by Kim, is that the quantum cohomology of the flag manifold and of type A is isomorphic to the coordinate ring of Y0 of the top one. And that's exactly, I'm doing everything over the complex numbers now, just to simplify things a little bit. And the equations, so it's a polynomial ring in the x's and the q's, and the equations which cut it out are exactly these equations. So you quotient up by the ideal generated by the HI. And this ring was already discussed in Elizabeth's talk and Changjun's talk. So this is the flag variety of type A. And now I can say slightly more precisely what quantum Schubert polynomials are meant to be doing. So as was mentioned in some previous talks, so this is Fomin, Gelfand, Postnikov. You have this quantum cohomology ring has a basis of quantum Schubert classes over the quantum parameters. But it's also meant to be isomorphic to this. And so this is not the theorem. The theorem is that the quantum Schubert classes can be represented by these quantum Schubert polynomials. That's the theorem. So the quantum Schubert polynomials, they're polynomials here, and their image in this quotient represent Schubert classes. Any questions? Okay, so let me switch to the other half of the picture, which is the half in which K-Schur functions live. And then at the end, I'll tell you how they're related together, or how constant sort of link the two things. So let's switch to the affine Gaussmannian side. So. So in Joe's talk, we already saw this affine Gaussmannian. I'm using the type A affine Gaussmannian. And what I will use is Joe already mentioned a part of it, which is what the cohomology or homology of this thing is. I want to talk about the homology, so the theorem. I believe it's due to Ginsburg and independently due to Peterson. Is that the homology ring of this space? It's not obvious that the homology of this space has a ring structure, and that's because this is secretly a group. This homogeneous space is secretly a group. But the statement is that the homology ring is isomorphic to. So first I'll write the sort of Lie theoretic notation. G check sub E. But in terms of symmetric functions, it's isomorphic to the ring in which the K-shaped function lives in. And let me explain this thing. So G in this case is SLN. G check is the Langlands dual, which would be PGLN. I think Joe actually had the other way around in his example, though for us it won't be very important. And G check E is the centralizer in G check of the principal nilpotent E of E, which for me would be sum over I of E I. Check doesn't really matter. And that is this matrix. For some reason, I want to actually put minus signs on the top, on the diagonal. So for me, EI check is 0 down here and then minus 1 somewhere. That's just to agree with the matrix I had up there. So Joe had DIs in front, but in this case we don't need any DIs. And yesterday in Joe's talk we had. So I should also say what the cohomology is, because that occurred in. So yesterday Joe talked about the cohomology of this acting on these IH GR lambdas. And the dual statement to this isomorphism is that this is the universal enveloping algebra of G check E, and this guy is Hopf's dual to this guy, and Joe told you about the action of E. So I haven't told you what this G check E is in this case, which is what I should do. So in this case, G check E looks like matrices like this, and I'm going to use H's as the coordinates because that's what they are. So G check E looks like matrices like this. So these are exactly the matrices which centralize this particular matrix. These are exactly the matrices in the group which commute with this matrix. And it's and this isomorphism. So the ring of functions on here are just the H's. So this guy is just this guy is just an affine space. And so its ring of functions is a polynomial ring. This isomorphism is actually slightly better. It's actually a Hopf. This isomorphism is actually a Hopf isomorphism. If you know about the Hopf structure of symmetric functions, and the Hopf structure here comes from the group structure of this group. So this is actually a group. If you multiply two matrices looking like this, it's going to be another matrix looking like this, and this gives the usual Hopf structure on symmetric functions written in terms of homogeneous symmetric functions. Okay, so the theorem which relates this to K-Schur functions is the analog of this theorem, but for the affine case, is that this H star GR, everything is with complex coefficients, I think. I usually do integer coefficients, but today I'm doing complex, so it's a little bit. So the homology of the affine Grassmannian, so on the one hand it's got this presentation, and on the other hand it's a vector space with a basis of Schubert classes labeled by these coset minimal coset representatives, or labeled by cosets of the symmetric group in the affine symmetric group, and the statement is that the Schubert, actually I should use a different letter for the Schubert classes, sorry. The Schubert classes correspond to K-Schur functions for some lambda, and we talked about that last week. So this is where my involvement in this subject began, and this was actually when I heard about this from Mark, who conjectured this statement around like 5 years ago. Any questions? So here we have two kind of different setups. So in this case, we have quantum cohomology. It's got a presentation, and then it's got these distinguished representatives. And again, over here, we have homology of affine Grassmannian. We have a presentation, and we have these distinguished representatives. And it turns out that these two presentations were related when Kostin solved this nilpotent total lattice, and I'm going to state his theorem. So Kostin's solution to So Kostin solved the total lattice everywhere, but the solution looks a little bit different if you solve it on a non-degenerate leaf. So this is Y0 is actually the most degenerate part of the total lattice. The solution looks involves exponentials and logs in other places. But it's easier to write down here. Solution to nilpotent total lattice. So let me just for shorthand write X for this the set of matrices which look like this, and I'll write X star in analogy with Y lower 0 upper star, is the set of matrices inside X such that the over there I set the QI not equal to 0. Over here I want to say the K rectangles are not equal to 0. So what does that mean? So that means if you've got a matrix, let's do the example over there. So if you've got some G which looks like this, then it lies inside this subset if the K rectangles are non-zero, and the K rectangles are exactly the determinant of the upper right justified square minus So G inside X star, if and only if H3 is not equal to 0, H2 squared minus 1X3 is not equal to 0. So these are exactly the K rectangles, if you know Jacobi-Trudy formula. And Costant's theorem is that there's a map phi, which goes from, there's an isomorphism from X star to Y zero star, and that isomorphism is actually the one given by the substitution that I showed you before. So it's like a rational map. And this solves the nilpotent total lattice in the sense that the total lattice was originally written in terms of the coordinates xi and qi, and it's not obvious how xi and qi change as time increases. But once you've done it like this, it turns out that the time coordinates corresponding to the hk, the time coordinates here are essentially just the power sum symmetric functions. So to express the time evolution, you just need to differentiate with respect to a power sum, and that's a very simple thing compared to the system of differential equations where the total lattice was originally written in. This solves total lattice evolution along TK, i.e. with respect to HK equals trace of is essentially dPK dT. Okay. So in the original total lattice, there were x's and q's, and there's a lot more coordinates than directions in which to flow. Here, there are exactly as many coordinates as time directions. Okay. Let me say a little bit about how this map is constructed. I told you the final result, which was that substitution of the x's and the q's. But I formulate it so it's kind of obvious how to generalize it to other root systems. So to get phi. So G is inside X star. What you do is you find a lower triangular unipotent matrix denoted n minus of G, so that G n minus of G looks something like this. Doesn't matter what exactly it is. So find some matrix which kind of rotates G. So G is upper triangular, act on the right and write it like this. It turns out that to be able to write it like this is essentially equivalent to the conditions that the K rectangles are not equal to zero. So the star part kind of ensures you can do this. Phi of G is equal to N minus G inverse E N minus G. And it's not meant to be obvious, but this is actually a matrix which lies inside that set Y zero star. So this is some linear algebra which Costant worked out for other root systems as well. Okay. So composing all the isomorphisms everywhere, you have this. So Costin's isomorphism is here. Star. So this given Tao Kim result says that this is isomorphic to quantum cohomology of the flag variety, except that I've added a star, which forces me to localize at the QIs. And on the left-hand side, we have this result of Ginsburg and Peterson. So without the star, this is just the homology of the affine Lissmannian. And I didn't leave enough space. But so to add the star, I have to take these K rectangles and invert them, because that's the star is the condition that the K rectangles are not equal to zero. So the coordinate on the level coordinate rings, I have to take a K rectangle and invert it. So I take all the K rectangles and invert it, and I have this isomorphism. And so the final step is to ask what happens to these particular elements in this ring and the quantum Schubert polynomials in this ring under the sequence of isomorphisms. And that's kind of a mystery how Peterson noticed it, but that's what Peterson noticed, is that the Schubert classes here under this isomorphism get sent to Schubert classes. So the theorem is, is that this, let me write it going this way. I want to write exactly what the map does. That's over here. Which way is that? Okay, so I have to explain this. So this is unpublished work of Peterson, and which I worked through with Maxime Zono. And there's also another proof of this due to Leung and Lee. Which identifies that the Schubert classes go to each other under this. So I'm writing it so it's clear how to do this in every type. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to take an affine Grassmannian element and factorize it as something which lies in the wild group, and then something which is a translation element, so lambda is inside, let's say Q check. But then there are also some things which we inverted. In our case, we inverted these K rectangles. It turns out that the K rectangles correspond to, in this setting, correspond to fundamental co-weights. So the things that you're allowed to invert correspond to Schubert classes labeled by something in the co-weight lattice. And you send it, so the map sends this Schubert class, localized Schubert class, to this quantum Schubert class where the W matches with the W, and you collect together the weights together to find the power of Q. Depending on what kind of weights or coroutes you took here, this might be a negative power of Q, but that's okay because you've also inverted the quantum parameters. Any questions? Yes, it's true for we proved it for simply connected algebraic, simple algebraic groups. Yeah. Sorry? What's the idea of the proof? The idea of the proof that, which I don't think is the same thing that Peterson had in mind. I don't know what Peterson had in mind. I know Leung and Lee have a different proof of this. Mark and I, we kind of said to determine the entire structure over here is enough to know how to multiply by certain generators. So you only need to know the Chevrolet, what's called the quantum Chevrolet formula, to determine the multiplication here. And then we just check by brute force that we actually know enough structure constants on this side that it agrees, and a little bit more allows you to say that the entire ring structure is the same. So you already know that both sides are commutative and associative rings, and kind of the Chevrolet formula here. So how to multiply by a class labeled by a simple reflection is enough to generate all the information about this ring, and you check that you can make the same calculation over here. And that allows you to prove the whole isomorphism. So I'll just end by saying what good might be this substitution between quantum Schubert polynomials and K-Schur functions is that there's a lot of combinatorial properties of quantum Schubert polynomials which are kind of special. So one thing about quantum Schubert polynomials which I find remarkable, if you think about it from the K-Schur function kind of side, is that quantum Schubert polynomials are stable. So they are polynomials which represent the classes in the quotient, but the n doesn't matter. If you take a permutation in Sn, the same quantum Schubert polynomial will represent the class in Sn plus 1. There's a relationship between these special representatives in flags of n and flags of n plus 1, which is kind of weird, because if you actually do the same thing for K-Schur functions, you have this amazing phenomenon with K-Schur functions that K-Schur functions expand positively in terms of K plus 1 Schur functions, but they're not the same thing. There's also another property of K-Schur functions which you can't see obviously from quantum Schubert polynomials, is that K-Schur functions are actually determined by K factorial many irreducible K-Schur functions, and that's actually 1 over n as many as the number of quantum Schubert polynomials. So there's n factorial quantum Schubert polynomials, but there's n minus 1 factorial irreducible K-Schur functions. So K-Schur functions are slightly more efficient by a factor of n. And of course, there's a lot of other wonderful properties, like there's a t in the K-Schur functions, and there's no t anywhere in the quantum Schubert story that I know of. And I think the most fascinating for me is what the total lattice actually knows about Schubert calculus. So when you solve the total lattice, you're changing from your original position and momentum coordinates into these coordinates, which these coordinates might be called angle coordinates for this leaf of the total lattice. And there are these distinguished classes on each side which get sent to each other, and it's not clear what this integrable system knows about Schubert calculus, and I think that's a very interesting problem. Thank you.